Science fiction writer Justina Robson opens up the TARDIS to examine the ever-changing yet constant enigma that is the Doctor. Let's do the time warp again.
When I daydream about the Doctor, it goes something like this. Daylight. A creeping mist flows between thick vegetation. The calls of strange animals fill the air. Small reptiles dart between the trees. From a short distance away, the sound of someone whistling badly causes a giant saurian head to turn. The monster listens, then pounds in the direction of the noise. Snorting and steaming, it halts over the tiny form of a blue police box stuck in the primeval sludge. A man in a long coat polishes a screwdriver against his sleeve as he finishes making some small adjustment to the box door. A hot stream of monster saliva drips down in front of his eyes. He turns and looks up slowly, squinting at the enormous, ugly head above him, the open jaws, the rows of stinking teeth. "Blimey," he says, "that's a big one." The creature lunges with instinctive speed, but he's already gone. The little wooden door slams in its face. Then the sound of Hell's starter motor starts to grind. The beast roars and swipes a paw to smash the box apart, but it's already vanished. Cut away, and we see it tumbling through space, its little light flashing perkily. For more than 40 years, we've travelled the universe with that box. We've seen things you wouldn't believe. Dinosaurs roving the streets of London, and stars on Christmas night burning the city with blue fire. We've run from werewolves across the Highlands, outwitted Macbeth's original witches, and seen the birth of time itself. Yes, some of us became cyborgs, and others have run screaming from psychopathic shop dummies. We've visited Pompeii, seen Leonardo paint, and stuck our fingers in surprisingly many turns of history. We've learned to say titles like the mighty Jagrafess of the holy Hadrojassic Maxorodon fur without eating our own tongues. And all this is thanks to a lone traveller, forever cast adrift, but not lost in time. An intelligent scholar with the highest principles, he's a dandy, a joker, a late-night talker without the smoking or the drink or the sex. An engineer of the quickest calibre, a gentleman in plimsolls, a big coat, a hat. The elusive Doctor in his almost living ship, the TARDIS, whose camouflage as a 1950s British police box has made it the most distinctive object in the universe. Dear Doctor, how wonderful you are! How strangely British, for a being from millions of light years away! How human, for someone whose consciousness within our minds would burn us up like cheap sparklers on bonfire night. What do you do with all that awareness anyway? Doesn't it make you want to turn to drink? I mean, you've disposed of every opportunity for romance and lifetime companionship. Many humans, by contrast, have leapt at the chance to leave Earth's dreary domestic round and escape into the fierce cauldron of ever. How many hearts you broke! And in that moment, when the time came to defeat the Daleks for the final time, why was I not surprised that you managed to pass the honour of their destruction to your more human clone? And then abandoned him, with your true love on a lonely beach and under a bleak cloud of your moral judgment. Oh, Doctor, how could you be such a hero and such a drip at the same time? Still, when all's said and done, you've done us a great service. You've inspired us to be better people whilst managing an almost pantomime level of comedy. Yet you end up alone on a dark and stormy London night, hiding your tears in the rain. All your wit and vigour, your silly jokes, your capering is a dance on the edge of the abyss when all the time the joke's on us. On you too. I could forgive you anything because of that, of course. And I'd forgive you your misdemeanours for your greatest gift, which is to infect those of us with sensitive natures with an insatiable hunger for knowledge, for trying to do the better thing, and avoid violence as the solution. You show us our tragedy and its funny side, and you have a ball doing it. I still don't know your name, but I know who you are to me. You're a dream we dream of ourselves. You're an archetype who happened to capture enough of whatever we think of as worthwhile in a human being to stand the test of several generations. It's what saints used to be in the days when we still did that sort of thing. You're what people who've forgotten what Britain, and more likely England, are all about when they think of it. You're the civilised person's geek dream. If they went to Oxbridge in the 1950s and wanted a lecturer like J.R.R. Tolkien, Gandalf, but with Sherlock Holmes' mind, Jules Verne's technologies and Phileas Fogg's budget, minus the burden of a family, of course. We all know that domestic union equals the end of all interesting life, and certainly all adventure. You should post a warning on the TARDIS door. Elastic man on eternal rebound. Has issues. Good for travel? Likes pina coladas. Just don't get involved. Yeah, you used to be English literature's poster boy. Byron and Newton rolled into one wholesome whole. It's a rather masculine and old world kind of vision of Britain and England, with all the villains from the dark satanic mills and fevered mind of William Blake. The good bits are offset by the realisation you're in a middle-class fantasy. Maybe that's why you dumped Donna, the temp from Chiswick. Speaking of Blake and matters literary, Margaret Atwood once mentioned that science fiction was where theological narrative went after Paradise Lost, and there's some mileage in looking at Doctor Who as the direct descendant of not only religious texts, but also the moral fable and the inspirational pamphlet. Well, I like to, and it passes an afternoon. Meanwhile, let's see who else was included in this year's version of Merry England vs. Evil. We're not in Oxbridge anymore. In 2008's Saving of the Universe, and for those of you doing Symbolism 101 for Universe Read yourself, the Doctor was equalled in heroism by a telling collection of friends who could never come from anywhere but here and now. There's Rose Tyler, the pretty working-class every girl with the heart of gold, and her mum. Naturally, he fell in love with her. You're supposed to. She represents the best of our innocence, like Joan of Arc without the annoying religious fixation. Then there's Sarah Jane Smith, middle-aged single mother of a teenage boy and keeper of K9. She's the matriarch protector, a rather overworked and stressed home executive, a bit frazzled but still sufficiently with it to make a last stand. Meanwhile, as the Doctor struggled to think of a way out of the Dalek death wave, the Earth military brass had decided to, oh look, pass the buck of destroying the planet in order to save humanity by giving the decision over to Martha Jones, ex-medical student. No, I don't know what she's an obvious symbol of, but she's progress from Leela. And then, bringing up the rear for vaudeville and swashbuckling everywhere, comes Captain Jack Harkness. That's the second significant Captain Jack of the decade, by the way. The other one is Captain Jack Sparrow from Pirates of the Caribbean, to whom he bears more than a passing resemblance. Jack Harkness is flirtatious, deathless, an omnisexual super soldier and party animal. Can it be a coincidence that Captain Jack is also defined by the Urban Dictionary as a term for a mythical figure who takes you on a drug trip? There are no coincidences. And finally, we have Mrs. Save the World herself, Donna Noble, the trivia-minded, hello-reading, temporary secretary from Chiswick. One's friends are very telling. In the old days, this would be slumming it. But thankfully, now it seems the classless meritocracy, the Doctor promised, has come to pass. And he's joined us from his ivory tower. You've come a long way, Doctor. And although you are wittier and prettier than you used to be, you're notably still rubbish at weddings, particularly your own. And then there are the opponents, the monsters and aliens who are everything we dislike about ourselves and keep trying to kill off, not least in the Daleks, our tribal unease now so threatening to global community. That sneaking feeling that everything would be so much better if there was no opposition left alive. It's almost a shame they didn't win. Then we'd have to find an answer to the question, what do the Daleks do after they've annihilated everything else? I imagine a couple of minutes of silence, followed by some nervous glances. Nobody really wants to meet the Supreme Dalek's gaze. Davros starts to drum his nails on his carapace. 30 seconds pass, and then Dalek Khan snaps, "Stop that!" Tentacles aquiver. This repeats for 2 years until the Supreme Dalek shoots them both, but he forgets to say, "Exterminate!" So he pretends he hasn't, and then he says it again, and then he shoots them again before turning in a little circle on his podium. Suddenly, they're in a play by Samuel Beckett, but without any lines, and the only two interesting characters are dead. Banality, boredom, and emptiness, evil's ultimate payoff. Admittedly, there's not much mileage in the Doctor Who story where our feet of clay loses the race. If the Daleks win, it's the end of the show. There's the weakness of serials. Because then you're just left with Cooking with Dalek Khan, 50 Ways with... What do they eat, anyway? Evil isn't just a one-sided ticket, however. The Doctor has his own moments. I can see the worst of us in his moralising, the pointless be-seen-to-be-gooding that wants to deliver moral impeccability and little lectures on life without realising that from his position of power and complicity it's impossible to sound like anything other than Tony Blair. I see the ugly, thoughtless and outdated science fiction special plea they always wheel out about humanity. We're specially clever. We think of the eccentric thing no other conscious being can think of with our monkey minds. We are creative, where even Time Lords fail. Look at us. You can't beat us. We're plucky and lucky and true. We're good. We're essential. We get knocked down, but we get up again. Still, at least he has his bad parts. And that's quite modern of him, certainly as a TV being. You're used to get that kind of moral dubiousness only in heroes of proper literature in the old days, or in later days in books and comics. It was late coming to TV, and still hasn't made it into Hollywood films, which are always the slowest trend adopters in the business. Doctor Who as a show is a peculiar creation. Like most screen science fiction, it isn't really science fiction, although it looks like it. It's fantasy that frequently employs a lot of horror. It jumps genres within series and episodes. It veers around, one minute camping it up, getting all soap opera, descending to slapstick, then shooting up to drama, off to melodrama, and recently, and unusually for this show, dabbling in romance. It has even spawned an offshoot, the Torchwood series, which is supposed to be more of the same but for adults, where for adults seems to mean lots of teenage angsty relationships among people who are too old to know better. This omni-genre fusion is the hallmark of much present-day science fiction and fantasy in literature, as well as on television. It's a high-octane plot burn of many complex references to past, future, imaginary and real events, as well as its own characters and locations. It constantly unifies anachronistic and contradictory things and succeeds by skating very speedily over the many holes it creates. It's fusion fiction, made by those of us who grew up with everything set out neatly in canons, with lots of rules and pigeonholes. Science fiction is this, horror is that, drama is this, romance is that. Now we just take what we like and stuff it all together for the sake of fun, but also because this is more like life. Everything, all at once, with no pauses, and once more with feeling. Doing that and getting away with it is quite hard. It relies on the kind of fast cutting and reading that you only get in a post-TV generation. It's fed back into books and other art so seamlessly we hardly notice it now. But for popular television science fiction, I think I can point to the moment it changed. It was just after Doctor Who died, or rather, was canned and taken off the air for 16 years in 1989 for the crime of irrelevance to popular culture. A crime of which it was sadly guilty. Looking back at pre-lapsarian Doctor, there are a couple of features which always felt a bit out of kilter to me. Romance and sex would be one, moral ambiguities is the other. I can say this only as the Generation Xer I am now, of course, and from what I remember seeing as a child and a teenager. The romance part didn't start to puzzle me until Tom Baker was the Doctor and Leela appeared. I had a massive crush on her. Did you know that she was named after a Palestinian militant? Bet you didn't. But in the tradition of filling Doctor Who up with symbols and reference to real history and activism, they decided to revamp Eliza Doolittle as a warrior hellcat in a skimpy, skin-tight leather outfit. She was self-possessed, sneaky, and liked to stab people who upset her without asking questions. It's the late 70s. I'll leave a moment for you to ponder the cultural meaning of this. Meanwhile, the good Doctor just pops another jelly baby, and off we go, leaving the elephant stranded and alone in the room. Leela fell in love with a Gallifreyan, by the way, and left the doctor to stay with him, at home. They had kids, I hear. Of course, they're all dead now, since Gallifrey was blown up in the Time War and made the doctor into the sole survivor of mythic proportions that he is now. The greyness of the moral world didn't strike me until Doctor Number 5, Peter Davison, the one with the Edwardian cricket gear and lapel celery. He had the decency to look permanently guilty for his role in the galactic hulls that spawned around him. But the impossibility of right knowledge in an uncertain and relative universe didn't really get a grip until much later. Although they tried this, boy how they tried it, as Doctor 5 vanished, and in his place we got Basil Fotherington Thomas channeling Margaret Thatcher whilst wearing Coco the Clown's suit. For me, this was too perversely surreal. Also, he was a mean egomaniac without a redeeming feature. He did nothing for me. I watched in horror for about 20 minutes, and then I switched off. I wasn't the only one. I took a peek at the next one a few years later, but I didn't like him either. The show had disappeared up its own singularity. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, they started making Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Although this took a few episodes to find its feet, it was a new kind of show. It was no more like reality than Friends or Frasier, and in addition it was a supernatural story, but it felt a lot like Now. A witty, fun, street-smart Now. It had sharp dialogue, teen issues, and universally difficult moral conundrums set in an ordinary suburb. Buffy wasn't there to lecture or be an example. In the United States tradition of hidden heroes, she was one of us, and she felt completely real. At the same time that Doctor Who reached its nadir, Star Trek, the series from over there that ran during the same period, carried on strongly. As the Doctor became Machiavellian, goofy, and irrelevant, Trek went politically correct and authoritarian. They both came from male styles of fiction, high on problem-solving, low on emotion. Trek was a Western. Doctor Who was a boy's own adventure. But for my money, Buffy kicked both their asses. And from then on, they started to take on more female fictional attributes. Domesticity, friendship, romance. Also, more moral ambiguities began to appear in Star Trek's spin-off series, Deep Space Nine, though it was trumped there by Babylon 5, a vast and finite space opera that made old Doctor Who look as appealing as wilted salad. But someone got the message. The Doctor was regenerated by Russell T. Davies, a popular and successful gay TV writer from Wales, who was as good at all that touchy-feely stuff as he was at the melodrama and horror. I can remember the moment when the first of the new series was due to air. Myself and a few hundred other people were at the British National Science Fiction Convention, and it was the talk of the day. At the appointed hour, nearly everyone stopped what they were doing and moved into the main auditorium where a big screen had been specially set up. With bated breath, we sat in silence, and you could feel the combined will of everyone there. Please don't be crap. Please don't be crap. We're all longing to love it all over again. It was as close as many of us get to a religious meeting. At the end of the show, spontaneous applause and a lot of talk. We did like it. Some more than others, but basically it had passed the test. Doctor Who was back. We went out to celebrate. Finally, to my mind, we reached Whovana when David Tennant was cast as the 10th Doctor and showed every interesting value the Doctor had previously had, plus all the new ones I wished he'd had back in the 80s. He's camp, fey, given to melodrama, whimsical, flirtatious, confused, and he's still the well-intentioned Time Lord who takes his responsibility to world safety seriously. Of course, it's still a family show, the high levels of horror and genocide notwithstanding. The difference is that now the family can watch two men snogging before one goes off heroically to die. Previously, they were only allowed to see them do the fighting and dying parts. I refer here to a brief moment between the Doctor and Captain Jack. Viewers of a sensitive and more blighted view of these things ought really to miss Captain Jack as the adventuring rake in Torchwood. You might go blind. I fell in love all over again. In spite of this tempting kiss and the many opportunities and loving friendships, the Doctor has continued his relentless, dry pursuit of evil, leaving the mess of real life and relationships to the mere humans around him. This is part of the stiff upper lip tendency of the British in general, although there's something very Victorian about it. The public moral face of goodness, that mishmash of piety and rigid class awareness that was particularly presented to children and those slow on the uptake. The trouble with using fiction as a moral tool is that it has a life of its own. It refuses to dish out your prophylactic plan and instead reveals your true nature to be flippant, irreverent, and much more superficial than you'd hoped. At least, if you do it right, it does. If you want to know people, look at the stories they tell each other. On this note, I merely point out that this year the church-going population in the UK was 899,000, whereas Doctor Who polled 10 million viewers. What me? Compare a trivial contemporary potboiler with an ancient and revered text and the best story ever told. Me? Wouldn't dare. Now, in dreams, only the dreamer knows the meaning of what happens. No matter what all those books say, it's your dream. You made it up from your symbols, all on your own. Stories, on the other hand, require a common symbolic language, as well as the written one. Nowadays, we've all learned to reference other stories endlessly. And we're all post-therapy. So we can talk about ourselves and our stories in metafictions, even whilst we're in the middle of them. That makes analysis less than simple. However, the golden standard of longevity for fiction is finding a character who can straddle the crucial cultural interests of the moment. These interests aren't subjects you can easily talk about in one word like economics. They're fuzzy triggers, emotional in nature, which are hardwired to everyone's sense of identity and social self. Doctor Who has been a fuzzy trigger for a lot of people. He's an unusual creation for that alone. But he's been helped because he's a science fiction creation. And science fiction is the most powerful of all story foundations because it lets you do anything you want. As much as you want, all the time. You can say anything and go anywhere. It also lets you muck around with symbols and metaphors to your content, letting them become real so you can cut straight to the mustard. It's reality, but as you know it, not as you see it. Chock full of interesting goodness. Speaking of goodness, there was a recent Thought for the Day in which Doctor Who was compared with the Buddha. But even in his heyday of rigid Englishness, the Doctor always conveyed a sense of having got away with murder. Yes, he always tried to talk sense into the blighters first, but often there was no choice other than to smite. The fact that this smiting was indirectly done or pushed through other agents has been held up as the Doctor's great virtue, until Davros, creator of the Daleks, pointed out in the most recent episode that it did really look a bit like murder by proxy. Now, you know you're on a losing streak when Davros starts taking the moral high ground. And this, just before he throws the switch to kill everyone and everything. Bummer. But it's not entirely unjustified. Later in the same show, the Doctor is faced with erasing someone's consciousness or letting them die a natural death caused by their attempt to maintain his mind within their own. Long story. He chooses erasure and returns the briefly brilliant Dr. Donna to a forgettable MacLife as a temp in Chiswick, who must never know the fact that her genius saved the universe because the knowledge will kill her. Rather hard to see that as a kindness. It's the kindness of the imperialist and the dictator and the pious judge. Mind you, there is that whole colonialist vibe going on in the Doctor's life. His superpowers versus everyone else's combined ignorance. All that moral difficulty was always there. And to their credit, a lot of writers pointed it out. After all, that's what good science fiction is for. Is this really what happened to religious thought, then? Well, let me put it this way. I'm a 40-year-old ex-temp from Leeds. 90 words a minute. If I have to choose between inconsistent fictions of unlikely characters who bear a passing semblance to real humans but have extraordinary gifts. If I'm meant to gain inspiration, find the stuff of dreams, solace and salvation in their story, then, for the price of my soul, you can keep your committee-written figures with their poorly plotted and unconvincing scenarios, their bewildered companions, their sidekicks stumbling in the master's tread, your Jesus, Buddha and the rest of them. I'd rather travel through eternity with the Doctor.
Let's Do the Time Warp Again was written and presented by Justina Robson, and the producer was Mark Berman.